You know, the stars are aligning. We just need government to recognise that and just support it to allow this sector to flourish. And that is where the HTA comes in.
Hi, I'm Kate.
And I'm Phil.
And this is The Underground, the podcast for garden sector professionals. Each week, we discover the trailblazers and innovators who are shaping the future of garden care in the UK. So, without further ado, let's get down and dirty.
So, we're delighted to welcome on The Underground this morning, Fran Barnes, the Chief Executive of the HTA. Fran, welcome to The Underground.
Hey, Fran.
Hi, and thank you very much for the invitation. It's lovely to be part of this.
Oh, thank you so much.
No, you're very welcome. Fran, I understand that you don't have a background in horticulture. Can you just give me a bit of an idea of your journey into the HTA?
Yeah, so although my background isn't necessarily in horticulture, I joined the HTA 15 months ago. I'm really pleased to join the HTA from a background spending 11 years at the NFU, yeah. The National Farmers Union. So whilst that's not just horticulture, horticulture is still an important part of farming, although food rather than environmental horticulture. Mm-hmm. We're calling it environmental horticulture rather than ornamental horticulture because it actually underpins the importance of horticulture for the environment. So although my background isn't as a horticulturalist, my background certainly for the last 11 years at the NFU is working with land-based producers, if you like. So I'm very familiar with that side of things, and certainly from a horticultural perspective, I work with the horticulture team at the NFU significantly. Right. Prior to that, I spent the first 20 years of my career at the BBC. Now, first of all, as a journalist working across local radio, regional television, I was much better behind the scenes than I was in front of a camera, I later discovered. But then in the last sort of 8 years at the BBC, I became the editor of the Farming and Rural and Environmental Programmes for Radio 4.
Okay.
So within my sphere there was Farming Today, On Your Farm, Open Country, Costing the Earth. I work very closely with Countryfile, work very closely with the Archers as well. So although my background isn't as a horticulturalist, I understand horticulture and the wider environmental issues from a variety of different perspectives, which I think is quite a good thing, actually, to bring that knowledge to this sector in leading the HTA.
Absolutely. That's fascinating.
Did you just fall into that within the BBC, or was it something that you thought, actually, I'm really interested in that. I'd quite like to get involved in that side of things.
Well, it's quite interesting, actually, because I'm not quite sure. I'd love to be one of those people that had got a career path planned out from the age of 18 and it just all fell into place and all followed. But of course, life doesn't happen like that because you just do not know what opportunities there are out there in 5 years' time or in 10 years' time. So I've always worked on the principle that you need to go where your interest is. Now, I was really, really fortunate. So at the time that I, just before I got into the Ready for Environmental and Food and Rural Affairs programmes, I was the editor of Radio 5 Live programme, presented by, at that stage, Edwina Curry, and then I launched Richard Bacon onto 5 Live. And it was produced by sheer chance in the same team or in the same area as Radio 4's, don't ask me why, it's a historical thing, as the Radio 4 Environmental, Food and Rural Affairs programmes. I wanted to move into that area. I found it really interesting. I was really, really lucky that I had the opportunity of doing that within the same team. And I never moved from that for the last 8 years. I've loved every single job I have ever had. I have been so privileged, and I've always done jobs. I've always applied for jobs and always wanted to do jobs that I actually personally know that I would enjoy doing. And the HTA is no different from that, but that's been my path.
Yeah, interesting.
It's a very natural progression. So can you give us an overview of the role and the importance of the HTA?
Yeah, so the HTA represents and supports over 1,400 businesses across the horticulture supply chain, from growers, manufacturers, retailers, landscapers, and we have associate members as well. So we are the largest horticultural trade association out there. We're not for profit. We also run the only nationwide gift card scheme for horticulture as well. So if people are buying a gift card in a garden centre that they can spend anywhere else through our membership, in many other garden centres throughout the country, that is run and administered by us. And that's a critical importance for the sector. It locks in consumer footfall and consumer spend into horticulture when there are so many other gift cards out there that they could go off onto the high street and buy clothes or whatever. That's really critical for us. So we operate that, but we also represent those 1,400 businesses to help them in knowledge transfer, with crucially more and more now lobbying for government to recognise the importance of horticulture as well. It's our 125th year anniversary.
Right.
This year as an organisation, founded in 1899 under a slightly different name, but that's the origins of the HTA. And I'm really mindful of the three pillars of importance that the founding fathers, they were founding fathers as well in those days, placed on why the HTA as it is now was set up. And that is about knowledge transfer and conferencing, the ability to provide networking opportunities across quite a fragmented sector, and presenting a unified voice for horticulture. That's 125 years ago. Absolutely nothing in those core purposes has changed. They're all still vitally important. And in fact, you could argue that the role of trade associations and the HTA, therefore, is becoming increasingly important as in a world of social media where one person has a very large voice on social media, the importance of a unified voice and clout of organisations coming together to represent a credible and united voice for this industry is absolutely more important than it's ever been, in my view.
That's a lot of food for thought, isn't it? It really, really is. So you haven't come from the outside. You've come from a more agricultural basis. So have you gained any insights, and has anything about the horticultural industry surprised you?
I've learned quite a lot of Latin names for plants.
Well done.
So that's been great. I struggle to remember them, but I do try and learn them.
Oh,
I think, on a serious note, this sector is incredibly generous with its knowledge.
Oh, yeah.
I've been blown away by the welcome that I've had onto people's businesses who just want to show me the new plant breeding that's going on there, you know, across the business, who want to show me the trials that they're undertaking with peat free, who want to show me the latest robotics that they've got that really help, and who want to share the challenges as well. And that goes across the piece as well. And I do believe that there is an ethos, which is fantastic, within the sector, that if one horticultural business thrives, then it's good for the sector.
Absolutely.
As a whole, because we're so interreliant on everybody else here. So that for me has been, and I'm not sure that you get that in every other sector, where it can be a bit more about, actually, this is about cutthroat competition, and also the genuine passion people feel for their plants. This is not a sector that produces widgets. You know, this is a sector that's driven by absolute passion. And I love that.
Oh, that's great to hear. And actually, quite a few of our guests, that's what they've said. You know, it is the generosity of the industry that they love. So thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking at some of the more sort of campaigning side of things that you do, and I know the House of Lords last year, after a period of consultation across the industry, compiled a report on horticulture. Can you tell us about the HTA's involvement in that?
Yeah, well, we actively contributed to the inquiry, whether it was through our written evidence, in-person evidence. We hosted numerous industry visits. And again, you know, the contribution that our members made in hosting those visits and again sharing that passion and that knowledge was fantastic, and to enable the House of Lords inquiry to hear from the people who were actually at the front line, if you like, of the impacts of any regulatory decisions that are made, was absolutely fantastic and hugely beneficial. It was brilliant to be able to demonstrate the wider environmental impact that horticulture can have, and the support that horticulture gives to the government's environmental plans, to outline the health and welfare benefits that horticulture delivers for the country, as well as the economic benefits as well. So that was brilliant to see. Mm-hmm. What we wanted to see as a result of that was something that was taken on within the report itself, which was the need for government to join up different departments to acknowledge horticulture's relevance across policy areas. So we want a government office for green spaces to be created. At the moment, there doesn't seem to be, from our perspective anyway, much joined up thinking about the impact of regulation coming from various different government departments, whether it's business, whether it's health, whether it's planning, across the piece, on green spaces or cultivated green spaces and therefore our sector. I kind of have a phrase that, you know, people need to recognise that cultivated green spaces do not happen by magic. They don't suddenly appear. They are grown, they're developed, they're planted, they're nurtured, they're managed by experts. And these experts need government recognition and government support. So that's sort of where we are from the House of Lords inquiry. And I think that all that was absolutely recognised in spades, if you pardon the pun, within that report, which was brilliant to see. And as a result of that report, members of the House of Lords who took part in that really did recognise the importance of horticulture before, but it was absolutely underlined when they took part in the visits. And incidentally, Kate, you were at the Garden Press event last year where members of the House of Lords did come along and see the Garden Press event last year. And some of them, even though they weren't formally invited, came again this year because they loved it so much. And this wasn't because they had to. This was because they actively wanted to. So you can see the impact that when people get close to this sector, the love that they feel, the passion that they feel for it, and the commitment that they've got to try and make horticulture a more resilient and sustainable sector in the future.
Why do you think that throughout the years, horticulture just hasn't been taken seriously by the government? Why has it always been kind of lacking behind farming and forestry? What is it? Is it because the industry, people are so kind of generous and nice that we haven't really fought our corner? Or is there just the wrong perception of what horticulture is?
It's really interesting. I suppose everybody's got a very different view on that. I mean, there's a pragmatic view that there are a lot, and we've seen in the world at the moment, there are a lot of priorities that government has to deal with. And I think that, you know, from my perspective, we're in a really good place in that I don't think there's anybody that would point to horticulture and say, that's a bad thing. We've got either vocal or tacit support, and that's a really good place to start. I think that when it comes to priorities, you look at the current situation with defence or the cost of living crisis, or that there's sort of burning platforms that the government has to deal with, and you know, potentially horticulture doesn't present itself, and I don't think we want to present ourselves as a burning platform. I think that a short-termist view means that only burning platforms are dealt with. What we really want to see is that an investment in a strategy, so that yes, government has to deal with the real crises of the moment, but that shouldn't get in the way of thinking about what the country wants to look like and should look like in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time, in 50 years' time. And that's where we want to really start moving towards government having a strategy for horticulture. And I think that potentially, you know, short term, we've had a lot of crises in the country. And potentially it was COVID that really underlined the impact and importance of cultivated green spaces as something that should be taken seriously rather than something that just sort of was a nice to have. But actually it really did underline the importance of having a strategy behind support for the sector.
Yeah, no, it's interesting what you were saying there about, you know, burning platforms and the government, you know, really focusing on things which are, you know, on fire straight in front of their eyes, as it were. I wonder what your view would be if we're talking about climate change and the relationship horticulture can have with climate change. And I think people who get into horticulture, get into gardening, their view on sustainability and the environment, because they're embedded in it, is changed. Their perceptions are changed, and they understand better about things they can do to help the planet. And I wonder what your view on that is, and whether that might be an angle with the government for their future thinking.
Yeah, I absolutely. Our sector underpins 50% of the government's environmental goals. Right. And, you know, trees don't just appear by magic. They are grown here. And one of our key, and actually sustainability is now built into many businesses, if not most businesses, SMEs across the piece, into their corporate governance, as well as perhaps being much more understood and supported by the public mm-hmm. as well. So, yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And that's been a key issue for us. So it's about health and well-being. It's about financial delivery. It's also about the environment, which is critically why we're looking at now, rather than just saying ornamental horticulture. It's not an ornament that it's nice to look at. It's environmental horticulture mm-hmm. because it drives environmental delivery.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So thinking about the House of Lords recommendations, 93 in all, which no small feat, what do you see as the priorities from that?
For us, a big win for us would have been, and a benefit to the whole sector, was the call for a joined up government. Now, what we really would like to see is a government office for green spaces to be created. This is an office that would join up the various different departments to ensure that any regulation, any new policy is joined up across the piece, that horticulture, green spaces, cultivated green spaces and environmental horticulture is factored into that. So there isn't a law of unintended consequences that a new policy or new regulation coming out of whatever business or whatever doesn't actually undermine horticulture. There's a lot of government departments that have a bit of a toe in the water in horticulture, but potentially not enough of a background or understanding as to the knock-on consequences of regulations and decisions. So that would have been absolutely critical for us, and it's something that we still believe should happen. Mm. So their recommendations do talk about more joined up working between government departments. That's something that we really would like mm-hmm. to stand. And that report does stand now. As a report, its recommendations are very clear, whether they're influencing the current government or any future government. So, yeah, that critically for us, that if you were to ask me to highlight one area, mm-hmm. then that would be it. The report also did ask for a strategy for horticulture as well. And I think the government's response in that was disappointing, that why would you not have a strategy for a sector that underpins so much when environmental delivery is so critical at the moment? Why would you not have a strategy that would support a sector that can support and drive environmental delivery? As well as the financial, employment, economic benefits, and the health and wellbeing benefits which the sector delivers.
So you touched on there about the government's response to that report. I mean, I was just wondering whether you wanted to elaborate on that, about your views on.
I'll choose my words carefully. Look, I think I'm not alone. I think the whole sector was disappointed and frustrated. It could have been a fantastic opportunity, not just for horticulture, but for the country. Yeah. It could have been a fantastic opportunity to kickstart the process of developing a strategy for horticulture, an industry which employs hundreds of thousands of people. It helps support the government environmental plan. It delivers so much for health and well-being. And as I keep saying, a world without horticulture is a really dismal place. Yeah. There needs to be a strategy to support this. And the fact that the government didn't seize on that opportunity to recognise the value of cultivated landscape and green spaces is disappointing. But having said that, we know that there are many advocates in government that really want to support the sector. So, you know, it's a response at a moment in time. Right. The support that we have, and we're growing. We're investing in our public affairs and policy team. We're forming more connections. Every time that we arrange or help or facilitate a visit from a Member of Parliament or the House of Lords to one of our members' businesses, they go away as advocates. Right. For this sector. So, look, it was a moment in time. It was disappointing. We need to move on, and we're not going to back down on this, because you don't just back down on one response. Mm-hmm. You take the wins from it, which is that there's a huge number of advocates now in the House of Lords. We've got a growing number of people who are not just supportive because they're gardeners themselves, but actually supportive of the sector because they recognise its vital role. And that's where we're going to follow through over the next years. But If you want to be glass half full, and I am a glass half full kind of person, is that the report recommendations are there. We've got a lot of advocates. We've got a lot of really motivated members that are passionate about this sector, that really want to embrace the chance to promote this sector publicly and politically as well.
Thanks. Have you been able to have conversations regarding this with the opposition?
Yeah, I mean, yes, of course. We're apolitical. We'll talk to anybody, and we do want to talk to anybody. It's important, you know. This is horticulture is not a political partisan issue. It affects everybody. So yes, we've got good relationships with members of parliament across parties, and that's absolutely critical for us. So yes, absolutely.
Okay. And did you get a sense that they'd be interested in relooking at this? Should they become in power?
I'd hope that they would.
Right.
We've certainly got a number of advocates that really do recognise the importance.
Yeah. Oh, that's good to hear. We're going to take a short break, but in the meantime, it's time for Kate's Corner, where we discover the musings and sage advice from the Gardener Guru. So, Kate, what are we going to be discussing this week?
Well, Phil, I don't know if you've heard the term hardening off.
I have heard of it. I have no idea what it is.
Yes. Well, it's not about being a cold water swimmer and getting used to going in freezing hot water temperatures by having a cold shower every morning. It's about how we get our poor little gorgeous little seedlings that we've been lovingly looking after and nurturing in our warm homes, turning them every day to stop them leaning towards the light and just cosseting them. What you don't want to do is then think, right, it's May, I'm going to chuck him in the ground. So hardening off is basically getting them used to being planted outside before you actually put them in permanently. Have you ever done this, Phil?
I have not. No.
So basically, anybody that's growing seeds, you know, indoors or have bought plug plants from a garden centre before they're ready to go out, you have to get them used to the temperatures.
Right.
So what you do is you literally take them outside, leave them there during the day, and then bring them back at nighttime when the temperatures drop. I know. It's so sweet. But one of the things you mustn't do is when you do take them out during the day is don't put them in bright sunlight because they're just not going to be used to it and their little leaves will get scorched. So think about where you're going to put them. And then you just start to leave them out longer and longer. And, you know, it's about 10 to 12 days, the process. If there is any sign of frost, bring them back in again or chuck a fleece over. And then, yeah, so this is hardening them off, getting them ready. To be put out in their final
positions. So is that something where you might use a cold frame or something like that?
Absolutely, yes. So you use a cold frame. But even if you're doing that, if you're growing something in a cold frame, you don't want to just quickly put it in the ground. You open up the lid of the cold frame overnight. So it's just getting plants used to that. You know, the cruel outdoor world, as it were. Because if you were to just bung your plant straight in the soil from buying it from a covered area in a nursery or you know, from your windowsill straight away, it'll turn up its heels and die.
Right. Well, that's a great tip then. Hardening off.
So 10 to 12 days, then they can go out. And again, once they're planted out, just keep an eye on that weather forecast. Any frost, once they're in the ground, you can chuck a bit of fleece covering over the top.
Brilliant. Thanks, Kate.
Okay. Thanks, Phil.
And back to the show.
So I'm changing the subject a little bit, Fran. as well as yourself, there's currently several prominent, several women in prominent roles within horticulture, but as a whole, women are still fairly underrepresented within the bigger roles in horticulture. Any ideas why you think that is, and what can we do to push up the women's roles? Or do you disagree?
Well, you know, I'd like to be in an interesting, every interview that I do, I have a question about being a woman.
Yep.
I get why that question is asked, but I'd really like us as a country to be in a position where women in senior roles don't have to get asked about what is it like being a woman in a senior role. We're not there yet. We're just not there yet. And I get why that question is being asked. We do have a number of senior roles within horticulture that are filled by women. At the HTA, I'm the chief exec. Our senior leadership team actually is majority female. We've got a finance director, director of public affairs policy, director of marketing and membership, are female. I look at Claire Matteson leading the RHS, Vicky Nuttall at GEMA. Yeah. There are a number of women in really senior positions in horticulture. So I think actually, you know, in terms of seniority, horticulture is not in a bad place. But I've got a slight aversion to the fact that we're sort of focused on what we arbitrarily call women in senior positions. Okay, yeah, I am in a senior position. But there are many women I look at in the HTA who are delivering fantastic, critical work for our sector that perhaps don't get that recognition because they're not, in inverted commas, a prominent woman in our sector. And this is about a team. It's not just about, you know, who makes the top 100 list or whatever. It's about a team. And you cannot function just with, in inverted commas, prominent people. So I'll give you an example. So today, I walked into our office and had a brilliant conversation with our amazing receptionist, Leslie, about how we're going to change the planting around Horticulture House. Right. She then went around delivering treats to everybody in the team who were in, and she remembered everybody's favourites. She made everybody feel great this morning. She runs a tight ship. She ensures that all our guests have a positive experience at the HTA. I've got a services manager here, Helen, who she'll celebrate 20 years at the HTA next week. She ensures that our members are catered for and serviced at a high level. We've got a senior events executive, Harley, who pulls together our garden press event, our national plant show, our conference, a future mechanisation event. Sally, our technical policy manager, amazing at helping our members understand the regulatory challenges that they're all facing, in particular trade and borders at the moment. And Pippa, a potentially present company accepted, but she knows more about plants than most of us will ever know in a lifetime. Now, I'm mentioning these. There are loads of others within the HA and within the sector. And I do think that it's about team now. It's not just about prominent people. And I think especially those women that are delivering so much behind the scenes that don't get the recognition, in addition to juggling home responsibilities. Yeah. Now, it's true that whether we like it or not, whether we agree with it or not, it's a fact that many women still do take the lion's share of responsibilities for caring. And if in inverted commas, you're running a home.
Yeah.
And I think that needs to be taken seriously wherever people sit within an organisation, because it is an extra workload that women usually pick up. Look, on a pragmatic level, every business needs to have a look at their workforce and ask themselves whether they're happy with how it looks on a wider scale, diversity full stop. If they're not happy about it, what are they going to do about it? And we're doing that at the HTA right now when we signed up to the charter on ED&I. It's not just about women, it's about inclusion on a wider level. And businesses, and I count the HTA in that, and I count businesses outside horticulture in that as well, but businesses who don't encourage, foster and promote diversity are just not future-proofing themselves in terms of the relevance to the public, but also practically when they're dealing with the pressing recruitment challenges that we've got at the moment. And that does mean for some potentially a change of expectations, of flexibility, more emphasis on work-life balance. But this is now about making businesses, your business, you know, our business, is attractive to a wider group as possible. So that's sort of a very long answer to that, what seemed to be quite a simple question about the role of women. But I think that, you know, it's about team. It's about diversity and inclusion in its widest sense.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Can you just tell me a little bit about some of the other challenges that you think that the industry is currently facing and whether there are any others that are on the horizon that you can see coming?
I'll talk about weather in a second because I don't know about you, but the skies are very, very grey here, and I'm absolutely sick, as our members are. You know, I think whenever people are listening to it, the chances of it raining are quite high. Yeah. If you're basing it on this year so far, so I'll come on to that in a second because that is a challenge, and we can't control the weather, but there are other things that we can perhaps mitigate that. But I'm just going to talk about trade and borders.
Please do
first. So 30th of April, a change in the regime of trade within the borders of importing plants for our sector. This is going to add cost. It's going to potentially add delays. It's going to potentially, the move to inspections at the border has got the potential to impact significantly on our members' businesses. Now, what we want to see is the place of destination system and regime being able to run, or certainly not switched off, so it can run alongside any changes that are going to be imposed. It seems wrong and not very well thought out to implement these changes on the 30th of April at peak import season. We've pressed that point. We're still pressing that point, and we are getting some cut through here. Now, what we're doing as well is behind the scenes lobbying on this, but also working with our members to ensure that everybody is aware of the impact, the changes that they're going to have to make to their businesses and the mitigations that they're going to put in place to ensure that that journey is smooth. But it is an example of, you know, horticulture has been one of the most impacted sectors from this issue, full stop. It's testament to our members that since Brexit and the changes that have come about since Brexit, that these have just been, you know, they've been dealt with really successfully by our members' businesses. Yes, there've been glitches, but actually in a very positive way of trying to overcome the challenges. But it just feels that this is, again, an arbitrary date set in a really unhelpful time of the year with no particular real understanding of the impact that it could have on our members' business. So, you know, I was out at one of our tree producing and importer businesses and watching trees getting unloaded from a lorry, it is like Jenga. If that happens at a port and then for them to be reloaded in again, it's a head scratcher as to how that's going to work. So it's that understanding of the real impact, and our role is to try and get those people who are making those decisions out to see the real impact on the ground of a decision that looks fine on paper behind a desk in Whitehall. So there are real challenges coming up on the 30th of April. We've got challenges around the cost of doing business at the moment, you know, wage increases, global uncertainty causing delivery delays, higher energy costs, which is significant for many of our members, elevated shipping container costs, as well as delays at the moment as well. So, and higher business rates. For instance, retail crime, you know, if I look at garden centres, it's a big issue for our garden centres when you're talking about shoplifting. We've seen the announcement just today that assaulting a shop worker is now going to be regarded as separate a criminal offence. That's good because it does recognise the front-facing role that people who work in retail establishments have. Mm-hmm. What we really want, though, is to see a better response rate and shoplifting taken in addition to assault, but shoplifting taken much more seriously because it can undermine the bottom line of many, many garden centres out there. And I am going to talk about the weather because I'm British and that's what we do. Last year we had the wettest March in 30 years. We've just come out it's April now, but March this year was very wet, as was January and February. And I think, well, so what I'm seeing, the floodwaters subsiding it's good, but the ground is just waterlogged, which is just a challenge to our growers, but also is just hampering demand and footfall in garden centres, because people just can't get into their gardens at all. The frustration, I suppose, longer term, is that we've had so much water, but will that mean that there will not be a hosepipe ban or any water restrictions in the summer? We just don't know. And the fact that we've got so much water, but we haven't got a government strategy about water resilience, is a concern. So I'm looking at some of our members who've struggled to get permission to build reservoirs or funding or support to build reservoirs. You know, I went to one recently that raised, you know, that funded the reservoir over a period of years for themselves, and then found that when they built this reservoir, which was being filled with runoff from their own glasshouses, they then had to apply for a license to use the water in that reservoir. This doesn't make any sense at all. So this is about joined up thinking, and again, the importance of having a strategy for how we're going to support this sector. So weather is an issue, but there are things that we can't control. The weather, although horticulture can contribute to a net zero future. But there are things now that we can do to help our businesses and mitigate the impact of the weather. And that's something that's high on our agenda at the moment.
So, well, we've talked about the kind of the negatives, as it were. Let's be more positive. And what do you see as some of the biggest opportunities in the industry right now?
There are loads of opportunities. I look at the Oxford Economics and Foresight Factory report, which identified the potential for horticulture to grow by £13 billion in its contribution to the economy by 2030. I look at, you know, the demographic currently of people that spend money within the sector, you know, for people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, older, that population is growing. There is a public, a cultural and political demand for gardens and green spaces, and a recognition of the value that they contribute, and value in its broadest possible terms across the country. Lockdown, if you're going to search for positives in lockdown, it created a love of gardening and an appreciation for gardening. I look at the number of new homes that are being built. Most of those houses have gardens. There is the potential there for people who've got a blank canvas to invest and to create their own green haven there, which the industry can capitalise upon. So there is a huge amount of opportunity there. I can't see now a position where anybody would say now that green spaces are not important to the country. So I think as a sector, we're resilient, we've got innovation, we've got passion, and we've got a lot of boxes being ticked to allow that, you know, it, with the right support and with the right regulation, to achieve its potential. Everything, you know, the stars are aligning. We just need government to recognise that and just support it to allow this sector to flourish. And that is where the HTA comes in, as one of the organisations that is going to be lobbying hard to ensure that the industry can flourish in the future.
Brilliant.
Fantastic.
So, Fran, obviously it seems like you really like the passion that's within the horticultural sector. Is that what you say you enjoy most, or are there other things that you're enjoying?
It's hard to... Well, where do you start? Because there's little that I don't enjoy about this role. It's an incredibly privileged position to be in this role, and it's an important position. I don't underestimate the importance of my role and the HTA in representing this sector and fostering a future for our members and for UK horticulture, where our businesses and UK horticulture can flourish. That's a huge responsibility. I love leading the team here. We've got some amazing technical experts and huge passion within the HTA here as well as within our membership. So I really, really do enjoy working with the team here. And I've had some simply amazing days visiting members, whether it is seeing the cutting edge robotics, whether it's the new developments in plant breeding, whether it's just actually looking at the array of plants and flowers on display and speaking to the people with their visions for the future and what they're going to do further in the future is just absolutely fantastic. So what is not to, yes, there are challenges. There are challenges. That's true of every sector. But we're in a sector surrounded by, frankly, awe-inspiring, in some cases, surroundings. What is not to love about that? And if there's ever a time where, you know, it can feel that the challenges get, you know, just there's too many of them, actually stepping out and meeting a member and really having that passion reignited and the reason that we're doing that reignited is something that I always value and I really do appreciate and enjoy.
That's lovely. Thank you. And there's no pressure on this question, but do you enjoy gardening yourself? It's fine if you don't.
I tell people that I'm something of a Charles Darwin figure in my garden, in that it is survival of the fittest. So I love sitting in my garden, in my happy space at the end of a day's work where the last of the sun hits the bottom left-hand corner. I sit there in summer with bees buzzing around the foxgloves, and I find it peaceful, relaxing. It's a mindful space, and there is simply nothing better than that. I really struggle with weeds, and I'm learning to try and love them and embrace them rather than resent them. I'm not going to lie, I really don't enjoy mowing lawns and I really don't like edging, but I love planting. And during lockdown, probably like many other people, I created a small allotment area and took delivery of a greenhouse and did almost become self-sufficient in fruit and veg. Now that allotment area is now going to sadly be covered back in lawn again, except for some fruit trees. I've got pear, plum, cherry and apple and some raspberry canes, which will stay there because I just don't have time to tend it. Yeah. But I did also in lockdown take delivery of a greenhouse, which is extremely productive, but it is like the Sorcerer's Apprentice when I look in there. You know, the cucumber plants that had no cucumbers on them yesterday suddenly have 20 on them today. And what do you do with all those cucumbers? So that can be quite stressful. So yes, I do love gardening. I fight a constant battle with the weeds. I'm a bit of a fair weather gardener because I don't like putting in the sheer lug work of, you know, weeding and lawn mowing, but I really do love my garden when it looks good.
So do you have a plant or a flower that would always make you smile? You've talked about sitting outside with the foxgloves and the bees. Yeah. So if you're feeling down, you've had a hard day, is there something that will really kind of...
Yeah. That's it depends on the time of year, doesn't it? I really resent winter. I really dislike winter. I love summer. So snowdrops for me always make me smile because it means that winter is almost over and seeing the first snowdrops is a relief to me. So I love them for that. And that does put a smile on my face because it means it's spring is on its way. Bluebells. You know, walking into an area of bluebells, the smell when they're in an enclosed woodland area is absolutely fantastic. And the sheer, you know, the hit of blue that you get. I challenge anybody not to walk into that area and just think, wow, this is, it puts a smile on your face. But back to my garden, I do love, I'm a bit of a cottage garden fan. I love the height that you get in a cottage garden and foxgloves still remain my favourite because simply because I will watch bees coming and going in them for hours. I think they're beautiful flowers. They also self-seed, which cuts down on the amount of work that I have to do as well. And I love Buddleia because the butterflies that they attract. And a couple of years ago, my garden was full of painted ladies, which hasn't happened since. I think there was a year where there was it was somehow a huge number of painted ladies in the country. So I'm a bit of a traditionalist in that. But yeah, anything that allows me to look at the flower and enjoy, but also to enjoy the insects and the nature that also enjoys the plants is a bonus for me.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you.
Fantastic. Fran, I think that just about wraps everything up. So thanks ever so much, Fran, for your time today. Really enjoyed talking to you and hearing about all the amazing work that the HTA is doing, supporting its members.
Thanks so much, Fran.
Pleasure speaking to you both. Take care. Keep gardening. It's great, even in the rain.
Well, for what an inspiring woman.
No, absolutely. And I think we've said this about other guests, about their passion and enthusiasm for it, but it's just so true, you know. Their Fran's passion for what she's doing and for the members and wanting to do, you know, to push their agenda forward is been absolutely really inspiring.
Yeah, and just so much energy, which I think is great for the industry. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So far, people we've been asking this question, you know, what do you like about being in the sector? They're all saying people's generosity, people's passion, people's willingness to share.
Yeah, that knowledge transfer, being able to share, you know, what you've learned and so people can gain from your expertise and your experience is really encouraging, isn't it?
It's also disheartening as well that the government is still not kind of taking the industry seriously. It does sound like the HTA are really trying and have really got a strategy, which maybe there wasn't a strategy, you know, before. So let's hope that, you know, moving forward, our voices will be heard a lot more. But it does sound like the HTA are really, you know, really behind the industry and trying to make things work for us as much as possible.
Absolutely. And there's a general election on the cards very soon. So
we'll
wait and see what happens.
Has Rishi Sunak replied to Lee Connolly yet? Do we know?
He has not.
Funny that. Thanks, Phil.
All right. Thanks, Kate.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, could I ask a small favour? Please take the time to review the show and share us with your colleagues. It really does make a difference and will help others to find us too. To keep up to date with the latest happening from the Underground, sign up to our email newsletter at theunderground.fm. I'm Kate Turner, the Gardener Guru. I'm a horticulturist, garden consultant, and presenter. To find out more, check out my website at gardenerguru.co.uk.
And I'm Phil Wright, the founding partner of Wright O'Barra, a creative marketing agency specialising in the home and garden sectors. And for anyone bringing a new product to market, we've created a handy 7-step guide to help take your product marketing from zero to hero. Find out more at wrightobarra.com. Thanks for listening.